Today's service touches on transitioning, and it is a time when the past becomes a little more present, perhaps. So we'll have a section where we contemplate that, and we'll invite you to do just that, to contemplate something about the past, this past year, perhaps. Might be an enormous, tremendous past element, or it might be something small, might be something, but something perhaps to let go as we head toward the doorway that stands before you here. So I invite you to consider the backside of this year, if you will.
And I have been tasked with telling you to move forward, which is an unusual place for me. As a historian, I'm usually the ghost of Christmas past. And here's what it's like to live with a historian. Christmas Eve, we sat at dinner talking about crazy Christmas carol lyrics. And my older daughter, Nell, who's not here today, mentioned, you know, the one that drives me crazy is a child shivers in the cold, let us bring him silver and gold. And she says, why didn't they bring him a blanket? You know? So, I mean, she's right. But I said, but that's, you know, that's do you hear what I hear? That's kind of a creepy Christmas song anyway. Creepy in the kind of shivery feeling that you get from the song. And somebody made the immense mistake of saying, why is that, Mom? I told them, that song was written in 1962, between October and December, just after President Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev had brought the world to the brink of total annihilation. And the song was written with that in mind. And it was written with the idea that the very smallest breeze that the little lamb hears has to get to the ears of the mighty king to understand that people wanted to trust them enough to not let the world be destroyed. So then we came to the second service, and if you were here, you know where that's going, because there it was. Do you hear what I hear? And Nellie turned to me and said, well, thanks, Mom. Now all I can think about is the Cuban Missile Crisis. And in that instant, I had, of course, destroyed it again for her. This is basically what historians do. We destroy all you hold dear through the long eyes of historical perspective. But you might be surprised to know that actually historians also are forward thinkers. We tend to be news junkies, absolute news junkies. I have 8 news apps on my phone with me all the time. I have to know what's going on, because the past and the future are so close together. They are separated as they are here by this door of the present, which is just doesn't happen that often. It only lasts for a millisecond. So we actually do think forward a lot. And with that in mind, when I was asked, you know, talk about New Year's resolutions, I said, well, I didn't make New Year's resolutions. I'm more likely to make a challenge for myself. And New Year's resolutions are tricky anyway. People make them all the time, and by the second week of January, they're gone. Because we always, I think, we make them wrong. We try to change habits when perhaps we should be thinking about not so much changing our view of the world, but at least influencing it in some way that's slightly different from what we're used to. And I do this some years, but not all years. 2013 was a year that the events just took me out of my usual pace, and I didn't need to have anything done. So I thought, I'll take 2014 off. I won't do any projects. I won't do anything long-term for the year. I'll just let life pull me around as it had done the year before. And you know what happened this year? Nothing. It was a rather boring year, which was good. I needed that gap year, I guess. So, but I've done different things over different years. One year, I decided I was going to celebrate the birthdays of every single president of the United States. And there are a lot of them, and I did do that, and there were, email blasts that went out. Various people here were on the list and got a lot of them, but we did. And every time there was another president's birthday, the little birthday candle music box came out, and we had a party. And then in 2007, on the news, it was everywhere. Everybody was talking about the new translation of War and Peace. And by everybody, I mean NPR and the New York Times. And I majored in Russian history in grad school, so I thought, you know, and they all called it the same thing. The greatest novel ever written, War and Peace, has a new translation. It's so readable. Anybody can read it. Another thing about historians, we don't read fiction. We hardly ever read fiction. I read fiction occasionally. I like historical fiction a little bit. But on the whole, I don't read fiction very much. But I thought, well, I should read the greatest novel ever written. So I asked for it for Christmas. And I got it. And I thought, yeah, I can get through that. Okay. I mean, there's a few Harry Potter books about this long, 1,200 pages. And I decided I'd give myself a year. If I knock off 100 pages a month, I can do it, right? Am I that disciplined? No. But I did read it in a year. And it's not made easy for you because Leo Tolstoy likes a lot of characters, and he likes to develop every character. And they're Russian. So everybody has a first name, a last name, a patronymic, a diminutive, and then women are sometimes called by their maiden name or their married name or Mishka or whatever. So when you have 1,000 characters who each have 5 or 6 names, it gets even worse. And by about the middle of this book, you start bargaining with Leo Tolstoy. I will finish the book if you will not add another character. And then Tolstoy just laughs malevolently and introduces an entirely new family. But anyway, I did finish the book. It was a year that I traveled a lot, and I schlepped this book around. And I still have postcards from all the places I went. I went to Gettysburg and Las Vegas and all these strange places. And when I pulled it out this morning, I noticed that I wrote in it all these places that I went. And at the very bottom in huge letters, it says, "Finished, December 29th. 10:30 p.m. in bed with the old bifocals." So it was a challenge for a nonfiction reader. I knew all the history behind this book, and I knew all the events that were taking place. What I got from it, however, was the heart and soul of Russian people. That angstiness that I had not experienced before. You don't get that through their history. And sometimes you wonder why a country reacts in a way that it reacts. And you will get that from novel reading, I have discovered. So it was a worthwhile project. And my family had to hear about it all year, too. In 2012, I decided I would read another book for a year. So I gave myself like 5 years between these projects. And I decided, okay, I've read the greatest novel ever written. Now I will read the greatest American novel ever written. Do you know what it is? It's Moby Dick. Moby Dick. I asked my mother about it. My mother says, yeah, that's a great book, except for all that whale stuff. Geez, Mom, isn't it a book about a whale? Shouldn't there be whales? Okay, but unlike Tolstoy, this is basically a book with 5 guys, 1 whale, and the whale doesn't show up until the last chapter. Did you know that? Embedded in the book is a textbook on whaling. And that's what my mother meant by all the whale stuff. So there's a lot of character. But the thing about Moby Dick is that it's not that you learn the heart and soul of the American people. It is the prose, the writing, which you don't get in reading nonfiction, by the way. I call it fact. You know, fiction to me is non-fact. It's the prose that will take you, the words, the language, as he spins the tale, as he talks about the whale. It's amazing. It was an amazing book. I'm very glad I read it. I finished that one 20 minutes before midnight on New Year's. None of these changed my habits. They did, however, enhance my life in ways that I never expected. And that's the kind of challenge that I like when I do a year-long project like that. If I decide at the beginning of the year that I'm going to take on a task, it's not so much I'm going to lose 15 pounds or I'm going to improve my eating habits. No duh. I mean, I just spent 2 weeks having M&Ms for lunch, right? So that's not a problem at the beginning of the year. So you try to do things that are a little more doable. I'm not going to try to, you know, keep my room clean or my desk clean. I'm not going to try to get my family organized or improve the cleaning in the house. You can't really achieve any of those if they involve other people. You have to do it for yourself. So you have to make things doable and make it successful and remove the element of guilt. If I hadn't finished this by New Year's, it would have been okay. I'd mostly been there. And I have abandoned projects. This year I was thinking of reading all of the Mark Twain books, but I decided not to. I can listen to ranting old men on other places. So. So here's your challenge. Here's your challenge. And we're going to give you a few moments of silence to work on this. You have a piece of paper in an envelope. When you are finished, please, if you want to participate, please address the envelope fully, which means include your zip code and your address and everything. You will probably get these back in March through our Fuse mail service from the children delivering them at coffee hour. But if you're not around at that time, we will mail it to you in the mail. So here's two things you can do here. Write yourself a letter. Think about something you would like to forget about. Something you just don't want to deal with anymore. Something you're leaving behind you. And then create a challenge for yourself. Something to try this year. And if you can't come up with it right now, you can say, you know, to be determined. And you can come up with it the next week. But do something that is going to just enhance your life. You read a poem once a week. Tell yourself you're going to talk to the dog, even though the dog is irritating to you. If you love to read, challenge yourself to not read. To look at a work of art every week. Do something slightly bad for yourself. You know, you always say, I'm not going to read that stuff because it rots your brain. Go ahead, read it or watch it instead. Follow a sport you know nothing about. Cricket, regional bowling, dart tournament. Grow a plant if you're not a person that gardens. Get a betta fish, and when it dies, because pet fish are designed to teach you about death, buy a new one. Talk to the fish every day. Decide that every time you meet a person named John that you're going to find out where he was born. You will learn more about John's over this year than you ever had before. So, that's your challenge. Try something like that. And we'll get back to you in a moment.
The world is changing. I feel it in the water. I feel it in the earth. I smell it in the air. The screenwriters of The Lord of the Rings took these words from the third and final book to begin the film. But it is the voice of Galadriel, the elven queen from the forest realm of Lorien, who speaks them aloud to us. I thought it was a good change. In these last December days, we come together as we transition from one year to the next. Last year's calendar comes down off the wall, and perhaps a new one goes up, familiar to me, marking old endings for a new beginning. After the holiday blitz of bliss, there's a quick shift into another time, maybe heading out for even bigger sales. Taking time for reflection, perhaps. For letting go, moving forward, another holiday, another year, another late December begins another ending. For years, since 1907, according to a Times Square website, the original New Year's Eve ball weighed 700 pounds. Spanning a 5-foot diameter, it was adorned with 125-watt light bulbs and descended down a flagpole. The ball drop, as it's been called all these years, seems to reflect a bright spherical irony upon our planet's progression. We look back on events that remain in our memory, those joys and sorrows, while looking ahead toward unknowns, maybe hopeful and excited possibilities, while the world continues its turning. And a big bright ball continues to drop down on display. The Times Square time ball has evolved. It now weighs just under 6 tons. It is 12 feet in diameter, with 2,688 Waterford crystal triangles, and 32,256 illuminated Philips Luxion LED lights. There is a certain energy leading up to the New Year event. The big build-up, the counting down to the final countdown, the minute, the final seconds, the passing of another year. It does seem to create a feeling for reflection throughout the year, though I admit more often, more so these days, I go in search of moments in stillness and of stillness for something I hope will re-nourish my perspective to reflect. The big ball drops. The earth keeps turning. While I attempt to make time for a paused reflection, not easy in today's world to be in a place where I pause, to somehow move onward from past regrets, to acknowledge the sorrow, yet seeing the gift, the joy, here, now, right now, at the present moment. Darker lessons learned for a greater light, for a stronger soul, and one at peace in the world. I am sitting up in the trees with one of the big five white pines as a backrest. The wind way up here moves the big tree and my body together, like a tall mast and a sailor on a calm sea. I've come to sit in my treehouse, to look out between the pressure-treated posts, the balusters, and the tall pines that frame the deck. Gray and subtle pink-dusted bark, looming up like enormously stretched elephant legs, whose ancient hides resemble dry and cracked mud flats. The light on the clouds lays a blush on each wispy shape between the dimming blue that will soon fade out altogether. All around, the empty maple, oak, and ash limbs reach up as if in salutation, but also farewells as vast tangles of chaotic intersections. I have yet to find a door to put up here in my treehouse. The deck is done, the basic frame, walls mostly, roof and shingles, but the door, nothing yet for my Walden in the woods. To sway just slightly with five pines, my saws and hammer have moved on and on to let so much go. So I'm building a sanctuary, and whatever my daughter's imaginations desire it to be. For myself, I will walk down the path that divides the myrtle and where the purple-blue scilla will reappear come spring, where my father walked when he lived here with us for his final years. But it is the doorway, not the door, that matters, because it was always here. And why I move, to keep moving through it. Doorways to pause in, openings for released breaths with wonders all around. The cardinal, the wren, the sound of dry leaves from a squirrel, the ongoing ripples of a small spring under the cedar bridge down below. And looking up into the pine boughs, thousands and thousands of long green brushes delighted to be up there to paint the sky. Even as the sun slowly beckons down in last beacon light, it reflects against the sky like the memory of my wife's smile, my daughter's laughter and singing, as the earth so elegantly instructs me to keep looking out, the way babies seem to do, look out, the way my infant son did when I held him in my hands, my belly his backrest, so he could look out. And so I listened for another breath in all the beauty of these trees. And then I remember again the tall old man, the founder and the former head of my son's school, who held me hard with his wizard's eyes before looking away to share with me his own heart-lost story, a slow deepening mirror for my own. "You've got to let it all go," he said. "You've got to let him go. And you've got to live your life."